If you're purchasing a new home or refinancing your existing home, then you need to call Team Hochberg, your trusted local lender, 855-563-2843, or visit 56david.com. Lower.com, Equal Housing Lender, MLS 112-4061.
You're listening to some music that Joseph Lindsley just sent us from Ukraine. We're connecting with him now. A lot to talk about today, including Vladimir Putin and the elections in Russia. Joe, tell us about this music.
Bob, good afternoon from Kharkiv, 30 miles from Russia. And this music we've heard before, it's that song called Vastopol, which was written by an American from Ohio in the 1850s during the First Crimean War. And this is the version by the great American guitar player Elizabeth Cotton. And I like to play this whenever there's some news, good news for Ukraine from Crimea. The song Vastopol means Sevastopol, the capital, or not the capital, but the largest city in Crimea, the occupied Crimean Peninsula, where the Russians have, where they had a major naval base. And it's appropriate to play this sort of joyful little guitar tune here today because, you know, as we look at what's happened in the past few days, the Russians have sent, for example, a missile to the center city of Odessa two nights ago to an art museum. They hit an art museum. But meanwhile, the Ukrainians have been using French-provided scalp missiles and other weapons to hit Russian targets throughout the occupied Crimean Peninsula. And so 2 days ago, we have reports that Ukrainians allegedly hit the Russian warship, the Azkold. It was a new ship, almost completed, in a place called Kerch, in a shipyard. And Kerch is in eastern, far eastern Crimea, at the edge of the peninsula, near that bridge that the Russians built to connect Crimea to mainland Russia. And so what this shows is with these long-range weapons, in this case from France, Ukraine can hit almost anywhere, probably anywhere in the Crimean Peninsula. And already, as we've talked about before, the Russian Black Sea Fleet has been on the run. They've been fleeing and departing from Sevastopol to places further east and to parts of mainland Russia that that are on the Black Sea. After that, in the early hours this morning, there were yet again reports of explosions at Russian bases throughout the Crimean Peninsula. And Ukrainian Secret Services posted on Twitter earlier today, and it's hard to verify this, but they're clearly trying to send a message. They posted an image of the Ukrainian flag on a mountain overlooking the city of Yalta in the Crimean Peninsula. And so it's appropriate to play this tune, I think, as we look at there's lots of activity, Ukrainian activity, happening there in the Crimean Peninsula, in the waters around it. You know, we have to remember, Ukraine really doesn't have a navy, but they've been able to use these long-range weapons, the Storm Shadows from the UK and other weapons from France and other countries to hit these positions. And, you know, as there's two American, former top American generals, Ben Hodges and Philip Breedlove, they both have been saying pretty consistently that, you know, now is the time to get Ukraine more of these long-range missiles. Ukrainians are showing that they can use the small supply that they have extremely effectively, whether it's the ATACMS or the Storm Shadows. They can use this very effectively, and so now is the chance to do it. And it's we should also point out that, for example, Ben Hodges, I just listened to a podcast that he made. It's called with the Silicon Curtain podcast out of the UK. You know, he's skeptical often of American war policy. He knows it well. He says we're very bad at regime change. He's not a creature, sort of that Washington swamp. But he's saying right now is the time. Ukrainians have proved they can do this, and we still see, I mean, yet another day passes where Russia has still yet to launch a major nationwide attack upon Ukraine in several months, especially since Ukrainians have got that Black Sea Fleet on the run.
And meanwhile, the Kremlin is insisting that Putin has not yet decided whether to run for re-election in March of 2024, but it's likely he will, and he'll get another six-year term because there's no one who can oppose him, is there?
It doesn't seem that way. I mean, even, you know, often in Russia, the opposition seems to be a creature of the Kremlin. It's all a charade. And it's so hard to understand what is real there. I mean, there's, you know, every once in a while we hear rumors that Putin is dead. Obviously, there's some good evidence that there are many body doubles. But another thing to remember is that, you know, Putin, you know, for one person to control a nation the size of Russia requires lots of cooperation. And there are many people who believe in his ideology. I mean, there are so many strong parallels, I think, with Hamas, even though Hamas and Gaza are so tiny. You see a nation governed by a violent ideology and a nation sort of enmeshed in sort of a bitterness that has made them, given them this thirst for blood. You know, and I was thinking, as we talked about yesterday, you know, some calls, you know, behind the scenes, there are stories in the Western press quoting anonymous officials, you know, saying that some people in the West are pressuring Ukraine to negotiate. We see pressure, south of here in the same time zone on Israel to have some ceasefires. And I've been talking with people like, why is that happening now? And I heard an interesting idea that, you know, for Western bureaucrats, they know that Ukrainians and Israelis, for example, these are democracies. They know these are people you can reason with. And what they know that you cannot reason with Hamas. You cannot reason with the Kremlin. They're unreasonable. They're, you know, they have this thirst for blood. They're governed by these sick ideologies. And so because of that, it's easier, sort of the way Neville Chamberlain was thinking in the 1930s. Let's try to reason with people rather than facing the monsters. And so that's the question for the world right now. Obviously, Ukrainians who've been living through this every day know that you have to fight the monsters. You cannot negotiate with them. President Zelensky has issued several tweets in the past day or so to clarify what he was saying in that Time magazine interview. But it's precisely this idea that we can't negotiate with these monsters. We can't leave anyone behind under, you know, the domain of the Russian Mordor. And that's why we have to keep fighting. But again, if you look at what's happening in Crimea, if you look at how, you know, it's as we get closer to winter, there still are no major Russian strikes. There was an attack a few hours ago on the city of Kyiv-Ri in the south. But again, that's close to the front lines. But the Russians are in some kind of quiet phase. And this is the time, Ukraine says, as well as experts from America, this is the time to get Ukraine what they need to win. Why is everything moving so slowly?
Well, part of the reason is all the attention is on Israel now, don't you think?
Yeah, of course. And, more and more, you know, maybe people will see that this, I mean, Hamas and Russia and Iran are very public about how they're working together. And it works out almost too perfectly, how that exactly distracted from all the efforts here. And when I speak with different NGOs and civil society groups around here, people have found a noticeable decline in support for their work since October 7th, since Hamas's attack upon Israel. At the same time, maybe two uplifting stories I heard. I was talking with Banksy is that mysterious graffiti artist that travels the world and no one knows who he really is. Ukraine has its own version. His name is Gomlet, like Hamlet. He's not so mysterious. Everyone knows who he is, and he paints these sort of uplifting, inspiring murals throughout the country, especially here in Kharkiv, with messages like "The war has taken everything from me, but yet it's given me so much." And I was talking with him going around the city a couple of days ago, and he told me about the story of there's a city, a small city near the front line, which is a hub for soldiers and volunteers, and it's under frequent missile attacks. The Russians know, you know, they're trying to destroy the people there. And there's a girl from that city, and she's about 20 years old. She could easily be a refugee living on a beach in Portugal or living in a German city, or she could live in Lviv or Kyiv and have a pretty peaceful life. Instead, she chooses to live in her hometown, and she runs a coffee window, and she makes craft coffee for the soldiers and volunteers. And she does that all day. And she said before she started doing this, she was consumed by anxiety about the war. But now that she's closer to the front with missile and artillery attacks all the time, she's peaceful because she's so busy. She's so busy helping the soldiers and making sure they have coffee to keep going. And so these little ways that people join the cause. And then there was another story of there's a lot of frustration. I think we can see that frustration in President Zelensky's voice in his Meet the Press interview the other day. But there's frustration here with what Ukrainians call the Monte Carlo Battalion, some of the rich oligarchs that aren't doing much to help. They drive their fancy cars through the streets of Paris with their Ukrainian license plates, and people are very frustrated with that sort of level of society. And my friend Gomlet, the graffiti artist, said he was walking down the street in Kharkiv, and this Lexus pulled up, a really nice Lexus, and the driver rolled down the window and said, "Hey, man, thanks for your art. Thanks for supporting the soldiers." And this guy was an oligarch. He said he looked like, you know, from the 90s, like Russian, Eastern Ukraine, Russian-inspired oligarch with gold chains and a Rolex. But his Lexus was covered with holes and marks from shrapnel, and the windows were cracked. And the oligarch explained that the Russians had occupied his country mansion, and the Ukrainians had to destroy it. And he sent his wife and kids to Europe. And after a few weeks, he wasn't really doing much. And he said, "You know, I need to redeem myself. I was a pretty bad guy in the 90s, and now I have a chance." And so he says, "All I own are my flat, my Lexus, my Rolex, my gold chain." And he drives that Lexus to the front lines every single day to help soldiers and civilians. And so these examples of people at different spectrums of society doing everything they can for victory.
We love those little stories that you bring us, Joe. It helps us to understand the larger story of life in Ukraine and the war that goes on. More tomorrow, and you be safe. Thanks, Joseph.
Thank you, Bob. Till tomorrow.